Hello, listeners. I'm just opening up with a tiny bit of pod admin before we get down to the main course of the show. I'm going to do my best not to mention, you know, the big thing, but I hope that none of you have resorted to fucking marrying, eating, or killing the people that you're living with unless you're meant to be doing one of those four things. And at least one of them is definitely illegal. Oh, shit, no, two of them are. Anyway, the business. First of all, thank you to our latest Patreon donor, Fiona Noble, who's chucking us $3 a month to keep on keeping on through this and other times. Fiona will be getting free access to all of our extra content on Patreon. We're trying to make it a bit more interactive at the moment. Me and Barry are recording something fun this coming weekend for it. And also, Fiona donating to us means that we are just six away from being legally and morally obliged to all of you to start working on our Worst Foot Forward book. It has been a proper ambition of mine and Barry to collate the finest stories that we found, write them up and see if we can get a publisher, because we reckon there's enough good stuff in here that that could really happen. We might, we will alter some of the rewards on our Patreon page, that if you donate to us, you'll get a shout out in the book. I'll talk to Barry and we can decide on what level that'll be at. But anyway, yeah, if six more of you donate, you're going to create a lot more work for me and Barry that we'll be very grateful for. Two other things to shout out. If you want to take part in any of the online things that I am doing this week, you'd be very welcome. 8 p.m. on Mondays, my comedy club, Good Ship Comedy, is going live on Facebook and potentially next week Twitch. This week is just a solo offering from me. Next week, I'm going to be doing something completely different to a normal stand-up club with it. I'll mention that at the start of the next show. On Wednesday night, on Next Up Comedy's Twitch channel, I will be hosting a live Q&A with a brilliant comedian called Robin Morgan, who writes for The Now Show and Have I Got News For You, and has supported Ellie Taylor on tour. His stand-up special is premiering on there, so I'm doing a Q&A with him. And then at 7 p.m. on Friday on their Twitch channel, I am going to attempt to do an online version of my touring show, Fable Maker, where I improvise a brand new story out of the people in front of me. Normally, they're live humans in an audience. This time, they are also live humans, but via a Zoom call. And last of all for me, Thursday night, 8 p.m, my personal Facebook page, Ben Vanderveld. I'm hosting a charity pub quiz for the brilliant charity Refuge. So just have a little watch on there. We all get a bit drunk, put the answers in the comments, and make a bit of money for charity. As ever, you can watch Barry's brilliant content on YouTube, the National E-Theatre, that is the E from the end of theatre, put at the front, where actors, directors and writers have got together to create theatre online for you to watch. There's some astonishing talent on there. Please check it out. That, I think, is all of the lockdown admin. Stay safe, stay well, wash your hands, wash behind your ears, try not to drink until it's at least 10:30 a.m. and enjoy the show. We'll chat to you next week. Knock, knock, ladies and gentlemen. Who's there? It's Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that each week uncovers the best of the worst. Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that each week uncovers the best of the worst who? Actually, you should say Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that each week uncovers the best of the worst whom? Are you really sure that grammar pedantry is going to help this already tired and broken joke format? As much as one person doing two voices is, good point. Although I think the two voices thing is definitely better than the pedantry, not least because you're only doing it to cover for the fact that you couldn't think of a decent punchline to the knock knock joke. Has there ever been a decent punchline to a knock knock joke? Has there ever been a decent punchline to a knock knock joke whom, you mean? Yes. No. Hang on, am I voice one or voice two? Well, which side of the door are you on? Not sure. Can you see a door knocker? No. Then I'm voice one. Hello! Who are you? I'm the chicken. Get back in your own joke. Well, I will, but you've got to get me back across this road along with this sack of grain and a fox. Back across this road along with this sack of grain and a fox who? Fox poo? Brown and sticky, I imagine. No, that's the stick. Who are you calling an astic? Ah, oh, bollocks to the lot of you. You'll have to pick up your delivery from the depot. Good day, sir.
And with me?
And that's our show!
And with me in this increasingly convoluted universe is the Irishman to my Englishman waiting for a Scotsman to turn up and make all this make a lot more sense, Barry McStay.
I imagine that is... Have you written many other jokes while in isolation, or is that your first draft?
Ow. I mean, the thing is, I have written things that I think might be jokes that I performed on Good Ship's live stream, but because I can't see an audience, don't know.
That must be actually, yes, for people, listeners who don't know, Ben's been sort of doing his comedy club, but online now. And maybe, you know, you can just imagine you're ripping the roof off of the gigs now. I mean, they're always great, but now you can imagine it's like Wembley. And the crowd
I would like to imagine that, but anyone who knows what a comic psyche is like, I will go from one minute thinking that I'm absolutely storming it to another thinking that everyone has left and I'm playing to empty chairs who are angry to see me.
makes isolation a bit more realistic then, I guess.
Yeah, it does. I don't know about you. It's hard to tell because you live with another performer, as I live with a very tolerant lawyer, but I don't think I'm coping with 4 weeks without an audience. I know that there are people who, you know, need food and medical supplies, but I think I'm becoming increasingly unpleasant to live with.
I think it would be really great if the listeners to this podcast would themselves get together on Skype and record the audio of them listening to the podcast just so we could have some feedback and then we can loop the two together.
Yeah, just for our own mental health.
Let me introduce our guest. Our guest this week is a comedian and writer whose Wikipedia page is an absolute treat. But first, the basics. Born in Newcastle, he studied at Cambridge University and therefore got a free pass into comedy. Having been a finalist in the BBC New Comedy Award, he wrote and performed in the BBC Radio sketch series Spats, which pitched opposing ideas against one another. Wait a second! But in sketch form. Okay, we'll let that slide. He's the founder and co-host of the Alternative Comedy Memorial Society, along with former guest of this parish, Tom Tuck, and has written for UK comedy institutions such as Have I Got News For You, The News Quiz and Newsjack, as well as co-writing the short-lived but critically adored sitcom Bull, starring Maureen Lipman and Robert Lindsay. Alongside all of that, he's a stand-up par excellence with shows such as Stad Up, a show about his father's death, Stad Up, a show about the end of his relationship with Nadia Camille, and his latest offering, After Me Comes the Flood, brackets but in French, drip, splosh, splash, drip, exclamation mark, exclamation mark. And those last sounds are the first time I've seen a comedian use emojis on their poster, genuinely. Wikipedia also notes the following, offered without any comment. Roberts also uses character comedy within his stand-up, as well as actual jokes, and that genuinely in the article has inverted commas around it. Roberts has had jokes nominated in the best and worst lists at the Edinburgh Festival. Roberts has created absurdist plays of unadaptable material. Roberts has said that he listens to the music of Madness pre-gig and once laughed greatly at an aubergine. Though, given his most recent poster, perhaps that was just a penis, and they are funny, to be fair.
Barry, you're reading that out like a rap sheet.
Now approaching the bench, as Wikipedia says, he has embraced absurdism, and so please absurdly embrace John Luke Roberts.
Hello.
You're right.
It's very nice to be here. I've stopped, my Wikipedia page came up like absurdly early in my career, and I just stay away from it because it sort of sends chills down my spine a little bit.
I couldn't quite tell if you had curated it or had a friend curate it, or you've just let like whoever your fans are.
No, for quite, yeah, whoever they are, the bastards. No, for quite a while, I think it was flagged for insufficient evidence of sufficient notability.
I mean, that's a pull quote to go on a poster.
Yeah, I know. That bit about the best and worst jokes is, that's always miffed me off. Because, do you remember Dave used, they still do maybe, yes, the best joke of the Fringe, but they used to also, they put 20 jokes on a list, and then the top 10 jokes they call the best jokes. you know, they get the public to vote on them. And then the bottom 10, they call the worst jokes. So it was just 20 jokes, which they polled. But also, they wrote my joke down wrong. It wasn't my joke. So it's not that I'm holding a grudge against 2010, being told I had one of the worst jokes of the Fringe when it wasn't even my joke. And that now is apparently on Wikipedia forever.
But well, no, not forever. I mean, we could go and change it afterwards if you want. And if you want any updating, do let us know.
Okay, thank you. Aren't you? Isn't that sock puppeting or something?
Oh, is that what that's called?
I think it's called something like that.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I think, funny enough, we had my husband on the podcast a couple of weeks ago talking about puppets because he's a puppeteer. And yes, I think he did mention sock puppeting is a thing that if he's especially, I think companies do. They set up fake accounts and have like people post positively about their products and so on.
I mean, companies do it. Russia's got entire farms dedicated to it.
How chilling would it be if they were actual sock puppets, though?
Yeah, sock puppet farms. Yeah. You plant the pinky of a ventriloquist, and then 3 months later, an entire sock puppet comes up.
You plant the cut-off fingers of fingerless gloves, and they're the seeds from which sock puppets grow. So, Luke, you are an expert in creating eye-catching comedy show titles, I would say. What would you say you're worst at in the world?
My memory is appalling. And
you already said that.
Very good. my genuinely... sorry, what was the question? No, I can't remember anything. And it means that I'm constantly sort of starting the same conversation with my spouse, and then they tell me, you said this all last night, and that's that, and then I get angry, but I'm angry at myself for having, and then the, you know, that's the memory is the what was the question?
That's weird. Are you with memory? Is it because I imagine as a smart person you've got a pretty decent memory for, you know, for facts and trivia and ephemera, which sometimes you might plug into your writing. But is it more like stories and recall?
It's sort of recall. I think it's kind of side effect of being quite high anxiety. Often you're not actually paying attention to what's going on because you're worrying about all these things rattling around your head. And so the world is just passing you by.
I've had a thought about this as well, that when if you're forgetful at a younger age, my memory. You get to a certain age, I've had it since I turned 30, that now when I start forgetting things, I'm convinced that I've had some sort of serious head trauma has occurred. or just it's early onset something, and it really bugs me when I can't then find my keys.
Yeah, for me, it's a kind of like, well, it looks like all that teenage dope smoking is finally paying off. Sorry, not paying off. So we're going to talk about the world's worst joke, which also I sort of feel is an opportunity possibly for Barry to return fire at me for the world's worst playwright episode.
Never. I don't remember any of your stand-up.
So Barry, you can go first. What did you find?
I looked at sort of practical jokes, and particularly I found quite a lengthy list of presidential, US presidential practical jokes of varying degrees of success. First things first, Andrew Jackson. I mean, an utterly unlikable guy at the best of times anyway. But turns out when he was a young lawyer, he was he went very Bullingdon Club. He attended a dinner at a local tavern, and as a joke, he broke all the plates, shattered all the glasses, and split the table in two, and then lit the entire place on fire.
Sorry, he lit the entire restaurant on fire.
Well, I imagine it started with lighting the table on fire. I don't know if the whole place burnt down, but, you know. But people tend to focus on, you know, the Trail of Tears and how he treated the Native Americans. So I think this story got bumped down the list somewhat.
I guess the worst thing about that is after he'd set it on fire and broken the table and everything, he had to stand there looking at him going, did you get it? Did you get it, though?
George H.W. Bush, he, in 2014, he was 90, and the background to this joke is slightly mysterious. His wife, Barbara, found basically loads of porn printed out on the printer in their home in Maine, in Kennebunkport. And nobody knows how the porn got printed out. But anyway, apparently Barbara Bush was very upset about this. And she kept badgering her husband to find out who'd done it. They obviously have people working in the office. Maybe some of the staff had done it. He had to find out who had done it. And the action he took was not to do that, but instead, he assumed the identity of Jay Smith, district attorney of Portland, Maine, and using stationery from the office of the Attorney General, drafted a sternly worded letter to his own wife. Which I can quote to you because I've got a photocopy of it here. Dear B. Bush, it has come to our attention that you have been using your computer to traffic in pornographic images on the internet. As you may be aware, this is a violation of the rules and regulations of the Federal Communications Commission, as outlined in Title 47 of the Code of Federal Regulations. Because you have broken federal law, you are required to appear in court in Portland, Maine. You will have the opportunity to answer the charges against you, specifically trafficking in pornography on your home computer. Please contact my office immediately to schedule a date for your court appearance. You have the right to bring counsel with you, and if you choose not to appear, we will send federal marshals to the above address. George H.W. Bush had someone drive to Portland and post the letter there so it would have the right postmark and everything, and then got his wife to open it in front of as many family members as he could possibly do it.
I'm staggered. I'm staggered because obviously George. He was the head of the CIA, George H.W. So that sounds like he wanted to give those skills one last run out before he shuffled off this mortal coil from what it sounds like cardiovascular exhaustion.
Well, he's never known for his sense of humour, was he?
Okay. No, I think George W. is sort of renowned to be a bit as being a little bit more of a wisecracker. Not entirely, you know, not the genius of the family, but certainly a pleasant guy to be around. Speaking of that, when the Clinton administration moved out, it's quite well known that they basically trashed the White House a little bit before George W. Bush's staff moved in. The best bit about it, though, is one of the best pranks is they removed every letter W from the computer keyboards.
Oh, that's so brilliantly childish.
But they also ripped out, you know, phone cords and covered desks and glue and stuff like that. They did about $15,000 worth of damage, apparently.
Oh, man, that's really childish. I've always been led to believe that it's a very stately handover. You know, there's the letters from presidents to each other that they leave in the desk drawer. I fear whatever letter Trump leaves.
I imagine it'll just be a cock and balls.
Yeah.
Lyndon Johnson, he's quite famously a prankster, isn't quite the right word. He liked to show off his penis a lot. He would sort of pee in the sink, and he'd get his dick out in front of women and on the front lawn of the White House and stuff like that. And he had quite a large dick, and he would say things like, "Jumbo had a real workout tonight," and stuff like that. According to one story, a Secret Service agent was stood next to him at urinals once and realised to his horror that the president was pissing on his leg. Johnson said, "That's all right, son, it's my prerogative."
I'm sure I read something about the B in his name also standing for big or bloody massive. Like, that's like a boast he used to make.
Maybe so, yeah. I think he did used to piss in the flower beds in the White House as well, I think, was another story I remember hearing. Troubled guy, it seems. But he had a slightly better prank when he would bring guests to his ranch in Texas. He would take his friends and family on little sort of drives around the property, and he had a blue convertible. And then he'd reach this sort of steep incline down to a lake, and then he'd begin to freak out. And he'd go, "The brakes don't work, the brakes don't work," as the car rushed headlong down into the lake. People would scream and try and get out. He'd have locked the doors. He'd let the car crash into the water and then start driving his amphicar, a car that could turn into a speedboat. Yeah, he had a car that could drive on the lake that he would crash it into.
So the first lot of stuff, I wasn't really sure counted as as pranks.
It's, yes,
you know what the line between pranks and common assault I think is probably wider than that. But I think it's a good prank. Horrible behavior, but it is at least it's a good trick.
Apparently, he would do it to members of his family, members of the cabinet, and foreign dignitaries. This is during the Cold War, let it be noted as well.
Well, he would just ride off some steam.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you've got to break the ice somehow.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt, he would ring the Secretary of the Treasury and make him guess who he was in bed with. And then when the Secretary of the Treasury would be like, oh, go on, tell me, I don't know. He'd say, a sore throat. A really weak line in, like, prank phone calls.
Really poor. I didn't think that FDR had the reputation as a player.
Well, no, I don't know that he did either, but he certainly enjoyed taking advantage of his position. When he was getting physio, because famously he was in a wheelchair for a lot of his life, he realised that if he relaxed his legs at the exact right moment, his physiotherapist would lose her balance and fall into the swimming pool. And apparently he used this to his advantage frequently. And on another occasion, he told a member of the Secret Service to get up on the roof of the farm to retrieve something or to check something out, and then had the ladder taken away. Having, like, the Secret Service around you just seems like a pool of people with whom to dick about every now and again. And they've just kind of got to take it. And I like this one. Harry Truman, he was meant to take a trip to South America with a group of reporters. And one of them was a guy called Tony Vaccaro, who the president became aware was afraid of needles. And Truman made the White House, one of the White House doctors, tell Vaccaro that they needed to get yellow fever shots. They weren't optional. He had to get one if he wanted to come on this trip. And so had him led into a clinic room, screaming, basically, I don't believe in shots. So maybe this guy was an anti-vaxxer, but in which case he deserves what's coming. But he'd enter the office and there was this giant, like a horse-sized hypodermic needle, like the sort of a needle they would use on a horse, not a needle the size of a horse, full of red fluid. And he turned around, dropped his trousers to have the treatment. And then a doctor walked into the room and went, this won't hurt a bit, Tony. And Tony Vaccaro recognised President Truman's voice. And he turned around and said, Mr. President, I do not usually greet presidents of the United States from this position.
I mean, of all the presidents, the man who was the first gentleman on Earth to have the big red button to release the nuclear weapons, I'm not sure I want Harry Truman to be a prankster.
No.
I will say, I thought that, you know, there'd been a huge amount of damage to the dignity of the presidential office. I didn't realise that it was always in pretty poor shape.
Do you think you'd like Trump more if actually he turned out to be a bit of a practical joker?
Well, I would actually say if Trump had a sense of humour or any understanding of how jokes work, I think it would make it, I mean, it goes along with empathy, they're similar things, it would make him a better person.
Yeah, it's true. Because, yeah, to craft a good joke, you need to understand other people.
Yeah, and all his sense of humour appears to be just, bullying and vitriol.
Yeah.
Yeah, they are the worst kind of jokes. It's like a bad joke is one that, you know, where you have to explain it. But, you know, that's what, you know, when you and me are at an open mic night and we're desperately trying to scrabble a joke back. But he's got a weird high status thing of just, you know, just going, yeah, that was funny. That was funny. You just, you know, you should be laughing now. That was funny. It's madness. Yeah, that's one thing you can say about Boris Johnson. Occasionally he can deliver a decent line.
Joke gone wrong, I am. I like this. Have you heard of the time that Zach Braff appeared on Punk'd?
Oh, wait, tell me again, please. If we both said yes, and then we just didn't say the story.
Tale as old as time. Zach Braff appeared on Punk'd in 2005. He was set up by Donald Faison, who played Turk in Scrubs, alongside him. Zach tells the story thus. Donald thought this would be the perfect opportunity to have me punked. So we got to a liquor store. Keep in mind, there are cameras hidden all over the liquor store, so I know I'm on TV. We go outside and these little... Donald obviously knows we're on TV. We go outside and these little kids were spray painting the car. I think that my brand new car, he had a Porsche, with like 100 miles in it, has been ruined with spray paint graffiti. They choreographed the whole thing and I wasn't supposed to catch the kid. But I caught him, And I'm not a big fighter or anything, but with the adrenaline and everything, I just started pummeling him. Zach Braff beat the shit out of a 12-year-old actor who had been hired to spray paint his car. It was fake spray paint. It could be wiped off very easily. They edited the fight out of the broadcast because apparently you're not supposed to punch children. But I say they should have left that in.
Oh, gosh.
In fact, Zach Braff's quote was, apparently you're not supposed to punch people on Punk'd. So if it hadn't been on Punk'd, obviously that's fine. but I have gone to the most famous joke book of the Renaissance for my world's worst jokes. This is called The Facetiae. It's an anthology of jokes by a guy called Poggio Bracciolini, first published in 1470.
I mean, that's it's a funny name.
Poggio Bracciolini. Yeah, it sounds delicious. It's the first printed joke book. And it includes lots of scatological jokes and things with farting and all sorts of stuff. The earliest edition of it dates from 1470, 1471. There are plenty of surviving copies of it. It was really popular, apparently, because there was an 1894 bibliography which listed it being going through 20 editions. So, you know, that's pretty good. This guy, Poggio Bracciolini, was an Italian scholar who had worked for popes. He worked for the papacy, and long-term listeners of the show will know I love a pope and anyone associated with them. And he said that the reason he wrote the joke book was because it is proper and almost a matter of necessity commended by philosophers that our mind, weighed down by a variety of cares and anxiety, should now and then enjoy relaxation from its constant labour and be incited to cheerfulness and mirth. Here are some of the jokes from the Renaissance.
Yeah.
A friar who was but moderately considerate was preaching to the people at Tivoli and thundering against adultery, which he depicted in colours of the deepest dye. It is such a horrible sin, said he, that I had rather undo 10 virgins than one married woman. Meaning he'd rather shag 10 virgins than commit adultery with another man's wife. Many among the congregation would have shared his preference, is the punchline to that. Yes, insert your own silences or cricket sounds at home, folks. The abbot of Septimo, a very fat and corpulent man on his way to Florence one evening, inquired of a peasant he met, "Do you think I shall be able to enter the gate?" "To be sure you will. A cartload of hay gets through. Why should not you?" That's the payoff to that. I quite like this one. Just because it makes no sense whatsoever. Several people were conversing in Florence. Each was wishing for something that would make him happy, such is always the case. One would have liked to be the Pope, another a king, a third something else, when a talkative child who happened to be there said, "I wish I were a melon." "And for what reason?" "And for what reason?" they asked. "Because everyone would smell my bottom." Is sniffing melons a thing?
I think that's a kid say the funniest things, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the fact that it's a child makes that funny. And this one, this is sort of the exemplar, I think. A young Florentine was going down to River Arno with one of those nets in which they wash wool. You know, one of those nets in which they wash wool. And met a frolicsome boy who, out of fun, asked him what birds he was going to catch with that net of his. "I'm going to the brothel's outlet," replied the youth, "to spread my net there and catch your mother." "Mind you search the place carefully," retorted the boy, "for you'll be sure to find yours there also." It's an early your mama joke, guys.
Yeah.
But essentially the punchline and the comeback is, yeah, so's your mum.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think a lot of these involve a lot of these involve there's anal sex jokes. There's a guy who there's a woman who's giving birth and the midwife is checking her vagina and she says to check her arse because my husband has sometimes taken that road. So, you know, there's. I think I'm going to put forward the facetiae and the collection there. Context, context, context. Maybe in the 1400s these were funny.
You've basically put forward a Renaissance Chubby Brown.
I suppose the difficulty with this thing is actually saying what a bad joke is. Because the difference between a bad joke and a good joke is often very hard to point out exactly and to get two people to agree on. What I love about jokes or one-liners certainly is that they work like equations. Like yeah. They're almost the closest you can get to a provable bit of writing because you can say, well, no, this adds up to this and then that is the ending, and these, you know, it's got all the parts there. It's definitely a joke. You can't prove it's funny, but you can prove that it's a joke.
Yeah. Is that, who said the thing about dissecting a frog and dissecting a joke?
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I can't remember who said it, but the frog dies.
Yeah.
That is basically it. Some of my favourite jokes could very easily be seen as very bad jokes. Like, what do you call an exploding monkey? A baboom! it's wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah.
But terrible.
But the word baboon in itself is funny anyway. So I think that's like...
Well, exactly.
That's an easy like forehand into the open court, that one, in many ways.
Use all the tools at your disposal, I think.
Yeah. There are some words are funny as well. I remember... I can't remember who I was having this conversation with, but certainly the name Spaniel is a funnier dog word than like a collie.
Yeah,
it will. There's the ooh sound, like, you know, goose, moose, classic comedy creatures.
Goose and goose honk as well. The word honk, a goose's honk, just feels like pleasing to say.
Mm-hmm. Getting into numbers and what numbers are funny and what numbers aren't. That's always
I heard an interview with Douglas Adams talking about why he chose 42. I think he eventually referenced back that they'd heard John Cleese talking about it in one of his the corporate videos that Cleese did in the 80s and 90s. He was talking about why for some reason we find odd numbers more interesting, so the meaning of life had to be an even number to make it more boring, and it couldn't be a magic number or a perfect prime or anything too interesting about it.
But it's the it's similar to, I was following a Twitter thread last night of someone with synesthesia, and they said, tell me your name and I'll tell you what your name tastes like. So whatever, Luke might taste of warm croissants and Barry might taste of spam. But it's the same with numbers. I mean, mathematicians will tell you that numbers have got a certain personality to them in what you can do with them, but... Like, one is rarely a punchline, is it? And I was trying to work out a punchline for something, and it had a different number in it every time. And instead of going through the numbers systematically, one night it'd be 374, and the next night it'd be 489, and the next night it'd be 8. There's no science. Well, I don't know. There is. That's the thing with comedy. It's science and art, isn't it?
Hmm.
I sort of beat myself up because I think, somebody else would, a better joke writer would have a funnier number than that as the punchline.
Yeah.
There are two types of people in this world, those who understand binary and those who don't. Which is, 10 types, damn it. Yeah. Told it wrong. So I
prefer that version better, though, because, you know, it's just, it's funny because it's true, that one.
I came down to two sort of jokes in the end, because I thought, I don't think you can say the worst a joke which isn't done right, like the melon joke, I think is genuinely a what kids say, isn't it funny. And have you read have you ever been on the Kids Write Jokes Twitter feed?
It's incredible.
Jokes written by children. They don't make sense. It's that age when children know the shape of a joke. They know what it sounds like, but they don't know how it works. They know that there's the rhythm and then you laugh, but so they write their own jokes and they're just wonderful because they don't make sense. In many ways, they've got that surprise that often jokes lack now, because you sort of know, someone's telling a joke. It's that surprise crystallization at the end which makes you laugh, and so suddenly having a joke where the punchline is does not a real joke is kind of funny. So I was at my brother's wedding in Enniskillen, or near Enniskillen in Northern Ireland, and my young cousin said, we were exchanging jokes and I had jokes and he ran out, and then he made one up, and the joke was, and I'm gonna have to do the accent as well as I can because it's just not as funny otherwise. And he said, what do you get if you knock over a statue? And we said, I don't know, what do you get if you knock over a statue? A job! Because they didn't have to stand there like the statue. And the sort of world that he threw, it didn't work as a joke, obviously. And the punchline, you know, if you have to, after you say the punchline, then explain not just why the punchline was meant to be funny, but like the entire actual
the world within which the statue exists.
Yeah, but the world around this, like this whole picture of, oh, right, you knock over the statue and then somebody has to, they're going to notice it's missing.
Yeah, so. Statues are very much like the Santa Claus, I think. Yeah. If you kill the statue, you then become the statue.
Yeah, exactly. So that was one of the ones I was going to suggest. But I realised that actually what I wanted to find was a joke which had started a war or something. You know, a joke which was properly funny, which actually worked, but could be pointed out as the worst joke. What I found, or what I settled on, because I sort of ran dry on that, in 2011, Barack Obama did a roast of Donald Trump.
Yes!
At the what's it called? The
White House the Correspondents' Dinner.
In which he told three jokes about Donald Trump. And they're not bad jokes. They're, you know, written obviously by good comedy writers. He's very good at delivering jokes. And they get huge laughs in the room. The first one is it's good that Donald Trump has put his questions over my birth certificate to rest. Now we can get on to the serious work of finding out if the moon landings were real or if what really happened at Roswell. And everyone's laughing and laughing and laughing. Yeah. And then there's a slide he's mocked up and he says, we get to see what it would look like if the White House, if Donald Trump did run for office and win. And it's just the White House with big sort of tacky neon lights on the front saying the White House and Trump and that sort of thing. And then the final joke, he delivers this joke beautifully, crushing a beetle very slowly, because he says he's basically explains a recent episode of Celebrity Apprentice.
I think he was talking about how he'd had to make difficult decisions in office, like whether to kill Osama bin Laden, whereas Trump had to decide whether to fire Gary Busey.
Yeah, but talks about it for this whole description of what happened. You've got the president of the United States, very, you know, and a dignified one, talking in quite some detail about Gary Busey and meatloaf and this judgment from these people running a meat van as to who had done it well or not, and Donald Trump having to make a decision. And throughout all these jokes, everyone is roaring, and the camera is just pointing at Donald Trump from the side, and he's got a fixed, very slight smile on his face. You can't even say it. He's not laughing. He's not pretending to find it funny. He's just rocking back and forward. And I think you could possibly pinpoint that as the very moment that Trump decided, well, his ego was so bruised and broken, and all he is ego, that he would, maybe he's just did. At any rate, that's the point, I think, which may have led to Donald Trump running for office and becoming the president of the United States of America. And I don't think that, I mean, I'm on Barack Obama's side on this. Donald Trump has obviously very recently been running his racist campaign against him. But I think that in terms of harm done to the world, that joke or that series of jokes may clinch it.
I think the other thing is as well that it does have underneath it all, and obviously Osama bin Laden, terrible person, but you do have the thing of, I was ordering the assassination of someone, is like the counter to whether to fire Gary Busey, which in itself is slightly uneasy as a setup for a joke.
Up until the past 6 weeks, one could argue that in terms of body count, Donald Trump is a far better president than Barack Obama, who he loved a drone strike, and he was a real bugger for a drone strike on a Tuesday, apparently, according to John Pilger.
I think Seth Meyers, he was hosting the Correspondents' Dinner that year, and I think he did quite a long bit about Trump as well at the same dinner. So he got piled on during that.
It's those that footage of him, and it's almost, I'm probably making this more sinister in my memory than it is, but you see the Trump's quiff and his little pout silhouetted and nodding, like you say, imperceptibly up and down. And I think you're right. And it's almost Shakespearean what's happening there. If you cut away the language, just who Obama is this incredibly refined, sophisticated, warm, charming man, and this dark, squishy, orange id who has got everything that he's ever wanted. And I would like to say that I had the foresight watching it at the time to go, Barack, you want to hold back on that. But what, like, watching it now, it's Obama's hubris.
Well, at the time you watch it and you sort of there just going, ha, great, yeah, this stupid little man will never come to anything. He's being ridiculed. And yeah, that's the hubris, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really... here's the thing. Here's a challenge for you as a joke writer. Could you write a joke about Donald Trump that you think he would like and enjoy and not become defensive about?
I honestly don't think he understands jokes. The closest he comes to jokes is sort of slagging things off. I'm not sure I've seen him. You don't really see him laugh at jokes. So I guess you could do a joke that he wouldn't mind, but it would be a joke not really where he's not the butt of it. He's sort of, he comes out on top somehow. I would say they were quite mild jokes in a way. Then nothing you wouldn't find on, you know, Graham Norton. Not that, you know, that was the way in which it was that final one and the way in which he reacted, which really kind of made this feel dangerous. Or it does. Yeah. I mean, at the time, of course it didn't. It seemed like, ha, 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 silly man.
Yeah, and it shouldn't. I mean, I looked, I don't know how I ended up down this YouTube wormhole a few weeks ago, but I was watching Don Rickles, who is, if you don't know him, he's an American friend of the Rat Pack, who is the king of roasts. And he's this little squat, balding, I think Jewish guy in his 50s or 60s, and he takes down everyone. And if you're taking, you know, if you're going to take down Frank Sinatra in a roast, you got to get it right, otherwise the mob are going to be knocking at your door the next day. And he does a roast, I think it's either part of Ronald Reagan's inauguration or a couple of years into Reagan being president. And, you know, remember, Reagan was adored by the American public. And Rickles, I mean, I think Rickles has a go at him for his dementia. I'm pretty certain he suggests that he's been shagging Nancy, and like really full on stuff. And Reagan loves it. I mean, it was a more charming, warmer, friendlier time when Republicans occasionally had the face of a human being on top of the sheath of evil that they are.
Thatcher, there's of course the spitting image version of Thatcher, which she reportedly liked because the joke was, you know, she was always in a man's suit, she was always very powerful, everyone else was cowed by her, she was this big strong authority figure, and that's exactly what she wanted to be seen as.
I've just remembered when Trump and Hillary Clinton appeared at the Al Smith dinner. I don't know if you remember that. It's a dinner thrown in New York every sort of presidential cycle where the two candidates always come and they sort of roast each other. And it's run by the Catholic bishops of New York, I think it is. And I remember watching it at the time. And Hillary, in fairness to her, can deliver a joke. She's always done quite well when she appeared in Saturday Night Live. Some of the jokes are written for... I mean, there's a mixed bag, but she had things like, "This dinner's for such a great cause, Donald. If at any time you don't like what I'm saying, feel free to stand up and shout wrong while I'm talking." She made jokes about the fact she used to charge for her speeches. Said, "I've had to listen to Donald Trump for 3 full debates. That's 4.5 hours. I've now stood next to Donald Trump longer than any of his campaign managers. Donald really is as healthy as a horse, you know, the one Vladimir Putin rides around on." Sort of great. Trump, however, "Hillary is so corrupt she got kicked off the Watergate Commission." Yeah. "Hillary, it believes it is vital to deceive the people by having one public policy, and it is only different policy in private." Boos from audience. "That's okay. I don't know who they're angry at, Hillary, you or I. Here she is tonight in public pretending not to hate Catholics." Ooh. And this one, of course. "Everyone knows, of course, Hillary has believed that it takes a village, which only makes sense, after all, in places like Haiti, where she has taken a number of them."
What is that last one referring to?
I think he was referencing, like, I don't know. I think it was something to do with the Clinton Foundation trying to help out in the aftermath of some natural disasters in Haiti. Oh,
the Haiti earthquake, yeah.
Yeah. But just, like you say, his like go-to is, "How can I bully, attack, and belittle a person because that's funny?"
Basically, Trump is a bad, faded jongler's comic.
there are various reasons why you might die from laughter. It can cause tonia and collapse of the gelastic syncope. There's also a cataplexy and the Beazold-Jarrish reflex, which I'm sure both of you are extremely aware of. Here are some of my favourites that I found. In 1660, Thomas Urquhart, the Scottish aristocrat, polymath and the first translator of Rabelais' writing into English, is said to have died laughing upon hearing that Charles II had taken the throne. There's also, I think this is one you might have talked about before, Zeuxis, who is a 5th century Greek painter, is said to have died laughing at the humorous way in which he painted the goddess Aphrodite, after the old woman who commissioned it insisted on modelling for the portrait. two more. On October the 14th, 1920, a gentleman called Mr. Arthur Cobcroft, which is a funny surname, a dog trainer from Loftus Street in Australia, he was reading a five-year-old newspaper and was amused at the price for some commodities in 1915 as compared to 1920. He made a remark to his wife regarding this, burst into laughter, and in the midst of that, collapsed and died.
And he must have seen a very funny number during all of that.
Yes, clearly.
Given the very sad news this week, it would be daft of us not to mention Alex Mitchell.
Yes, I know what this story is.
Yeah, in March 1975, he died laughing whilst watching an episode of The Goodies, the British comedy TV show, featuring a kilt-clad Scotsman with his bagpipes battling a master of the Lancastrian martial art of Ecky Thump, who was armed with a black pudding. And apparently after laughing for 25 minutes continuously, he died of heart failure.
Yes, Tim Brooke Taylor, member of The Goodies, died sadly this week in Britain of coronavirus as well.
Yeah, people always say in the news, great, that died sadly this week. I'd hope that when Osama bin Laden was killed, they went, Osama bin Laden died happily this week.
You know what, I've seen people starting to put like headlines about, I think, Stirling Moss died, and they said Stirling Moss has passed away of a pre-existing condition or of natural causes. Like, they've started putting like qualifiers onto stories that would normally be someone has died, but now so many are coronavirus that are having to state that it's not a coronavirus death. It's weird.
Bad news about Tim Brooke Taylor. I worked with him last year on they did a new episode of The Goodies for Audible.
Oh wow!
So it was a treat to work with him. He was lovely, like he just as you'd expect. It was only a day we spent with him, but as polite and kind and funny as you'd hope that he would be.
Yeah.
Yeah, he strikes me as a real Paddington Bear of a man. Just really, really sweet. Do you know, Luke, a comic called Ronnie Golden?
Oh, yes. Who used to do things with Barry Cryer quite a lot.
So he woke up to a phone call from Barry Cryer telling him about Tim Brooke Taylor's passing. But Barry Cryer apparently ended the phone call with a joke that he'd just written. And it's this. An airplane reaches the last stage of its journey. Good afternoon, everybody. This is your captain speaking. We are travelling at a height of 20,000 feet and an estimated time of arrival is 5:35. Heathrow is currently overcast with temperature 9 degrees with slight crosswinds. Thank you for travelling with British Airways. And just to let you know that due to government regulations, I am working from home. Love that Barry Choir is still always on.
Yeah. For anyone who listens to the show and you like our comedic sensibilities, you can probably find most of the existing episodes of I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue, a radio program which Tim Brooke Taylor featured on for the guts of 50 years, on YouTube. Someone has uploaded loads of them on there. So,
oh, have they?
Yeah, if you want to go on there after this and just listen to old men being silly, there's nothing quite like it.
Yeah, and like American listeners in particular, if you like Monty Python, get into I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue. It is glorious. And there's like the fact when you take away the name that the chairman of it was an old Etonian jazz trumpeter who ended up on a Radiohead album. Culture's weird. It's so weird. Right, let's go all the way back in time to ancient Rome and places like it. So, you know the saying about somewhere out there, there's a bullet with your name on it?
Yes.
Well, back when a different kind of projectile was used as a weapon of war, various different cultures ancient Greeks and ancient Romans, you would use the sling, the slingshot that was put in their slings, and they would put humorous messages on it. So that presumably when people were mincing to the corpse that they just killed, they would have a little chuckle at what had happened to them. So the messages on some of these pieces of shot would say things such as, "Ouch, be lodged well, and here's a sugar plum for you." Other ones included, "This is for dessert, crack your teeth, for Pompey's backside, and catch." But my favourite bullet that was sent their way was one that said, "Attack Octavian's arsehole."
There is also...
You have to be a really good shot.
Yeah. That's a trick shot at the end of the battle.
Yeah.
Can you name the most famous...
Sorry, it's your John Virgo's doing it now.
Yeah, I'm just imagining Jim Davidson on the White Cliffs of Dover slingshotting immigrants out of their dinghies as John Virgo commentates. Gentlemen, which do you think is the most famous piece of weaponry to have a joke carved onto it?
Oh,
the bomb.
Which bomb?
Are you going to make me pick a city?
Yeah, I'm not going to make you pick a city, but yeah, Fat Man.
Nagasaki had a knock-knock joke. Hiroshima, it was just a pun.
Yeah, no, actually, no, looking at this, yeah, it is Nagasaki. Rear Admiral W.R. Purnell wrote on the side of Fat Man, "A second kiss for Hirohito," which is a little bit dark.
So, okay, so me saying that Obama...
That might talking be a joke, actually, yeah.
Obama setting up the killing of Bin Laden is probably less traumatic than using the dropping of the first atom bomb as the setup to your joke.
Very lazy joke writing as well.
Yeah.
But also, can you imagine, like, the Rear Admiral trying to convince Truman, "Listen, I've got this amazing joke, but it requires quite the setup."
It was just a prank that got out of hand.
Yeah.
Sticking in America, a gentleman called John William Curtin in 1867, he was a temperance advocate. And amongst his many tactics, he put together 1,000 temperance anecdotes, jokes, riddles, puns, and smart saying. He hoped to try and win gentlemen over to the cause of temperance with these witticisms. So, first of all...
I bet they're funny. Why is... drinks.
See if you can guess the punchline to these. Why is there no life in gin?
No life in gin.
It's a spirit.
Ooh, that's better than the really grim punchline he's got. So why is there no life in gin? Because it is stillborn.
Oh, God.
Next up, a canter will give you ruddy cheeks. A decanter will give you a ruddy nose. And there were 30 or so of these, but the other one that really set my teeth on edge: why is the letter D a great reformer?
They're going to add it to some word and make something very earth-shattering happen. A great reformer.
Because it makes men mend.
I don't drink and haven't for 13 years, and this is enough to make me reach for a bottle of vodka right now.
Yeah, it really is like being savaged by a Southern Baptist preacher, these, isn't it?
Yeah.
I looked at a couple of jokes from around the world that require a lot of context. This joke, a girl asks an Argentine man for a light. He pats his trousers, chest and back pockets. "Sorry," he says, "I don't have one, but wow, do I have a great body or what?" Which I quite like. But this is a joke from China. A chess player who thought highly of his own skill once lost 3 games in a row. The next day, a friend asked him how the games had turned out. "I didn't win the first game," he replied, "and my opponent didn't lose the second. As to the third game, I asked him to agree to a draw, but he wouldn't." And it's basically because Chinese jokes just try and steer away from anything political or a little bit too spicy.
Okay, yes, I can imagine that's probably... it's probably greatly encouraged.
Yes, yes, it probably is. What else can I tell you about? Oh, a clown. In May the 2nd, 1845, hundreds of people gathered along the banks of the River Bure in Great Yarmouth in Norfolk to watch a clown sitting in a barrel as it was drawn by four geese across the river. This is a gentleman called Nelson the Clown.
Was Tim Fitzheim time travelling or something? Yeah.
Do you know what apparently the greatest act of clowning is, by the way? Obviously, Luke, you've been to clown school in Paris.
Yes, I have. Well, near Paris, isn't it?
Near Paris. I don't know if it's Grimaldi, but someone like him, apparently, his act was to go on stage and eat a red cabbage whilst crying. And apparently, that act just had people in bits.
Yeah. I have heard about it. I forget who it was.
All right, I was just enjoying watching Luke sort of weigh up the comic potential of that.
Yeah.
Well, I use lemons, which is, I guess, a bit broad.
No, broad beans would be broad.
You're very good. At clown school, and I nearly mentioned this in the with the worst joke thing. My clown teacher talked us through something, and suddenly a light bulb went on when he said, the clown does something which he thinks is funny, and the audience thinks, oh my God, that's awful. That's really not funny at all. That's ridiculous. And they laugh at how terrible an idea this is. And the clown hears them laughing. He thinks, oh great, they find this funny. And then the clown does it again and they laugh. They go, oh my God, he still thinks this is funny. He's doing it again. And then he does it again because, oh, they're laughing. This is working. And then the audience start to find the thing itself funny because they appear to be laughing at it, and so then you fall into that. So that in clowning, a terrible joke is often a really good joke.
Well, it's because that's what Tim Vine often does. In amongst the brilliantly written jokes, there's a load of endearing shite that he uses to keep the momentum going.
He has this, he just sort of got, you know, for 20 minutes at a time, there's just that barrage. Then he always gives that rest of a song or something which doesn't really have the puns in, and it's back to barrage again, and it works, that sort of, that insistence.
It's weird, isn't it? Because insistence is something that you don't really want to associate with a sense of humour. But that is, yeah, I've not heard that word associated with Tim, and it's bang on the money. Anyway, let me tell you about a really fucking stupid clown. So we're in Great Yarmouth. He's being drawn across the river. As you can imagine, big crowd there, 300 to 400 people climbed onto the Great Yarmouth Suspension Bridge to get a better view as he sailed past. However, this proved disastrous as the structure could not support the massive weight. The cable snapped and threw everybody into the water. At the end of the rescue operation, 79 people had died.
Oh.
So, hey, come on. Tragedy plus time, guys. Tragedy plus time.
No, 79 isn't a funny enough number.
The clown, all right.
Yeah, I think he came out of it okay.
Did any geese survive?
There is no reporting on the state of the goose.
And yeah, you see, it's funny if it's one goose. Again, geese isn't as funny a word as goose.
Yeah, 79 people died, but one goose survived.
You know that old, when there's a car crash off screen and you just see a wheel, like, spin down? If that happened, but with the geese off screen, and then, I don't know, a beak just kind of tumbled.
Oh, tell you what, Untitled Goose Game would be much bleaker if one of the pranks you had to play in that computer game was to try and cause the death of 79 onlookers.
I'm going to tell you about one stupid person, and then I'll give you my suggestion. A 17-year-old called Juan Luis Lagunas Rosales was known as El Pirata de Culiacan, the Pirate of the Culiacan, and he was a popular comedian in Mexico, until he decided to make a joke about Ruben Oseguera Cervantes, a.k.a. El Mencho, clearly a Mexican gangster who was loved by Yiddish grandmothers. He made some jokes about El Mencho, including the phrase, El Mencho, peel my cock. And it didn't go down very well. So, a few nights later, Rosales posted on Facebook and Instagram that he was going down to a local pub and some fans had come over and joined him for a drink. And instead, some of El Mencho's goons came along and shot him 15 times. I mean, in terms of people that you shouldn't make jokes about, maybe not the Mexican mob.
Yeah, I feel like that's a crowd that really got out of hand somehow.
Because you want these kind of, you know, the saying truth to power, these, you know, the people who dared tell the jokes, other people who wouldn't. You want the jokes to be a bit better than peel my cock.
To be fair, did they choose to shoot him with a heckler and cock?
Yes.
that would have been ideal.
I mean, the thing is, peel my cock sounds like the sort of thing that Richard Briers would say if he was slightly surprised during The Good Life.
Peel my cock.
whilst we're staying around the nether region, sorry, one quickie that I saw. In AD 66, obviously not a great time to be living in Judea because the Romans were taking it over, but there was a lot of uprising there. And apparently, as some soldiers were marching through town, one of them decided to wind up Jewish pilgrims who'd gone there for Passover and mooned them. And the insulted pilgrims threw rocks at the soldiers, who then deployed reinforcements. The resulting stampede left 10,000 people dead, and that riot was one of the causes to the First Judeo-Roman War, which went on to lead to the destruction of the Second Temple.
That's a very powerful arse.
The worst joke I could find is this. Soviet Russia. You'll be unsurprised
to know.
So many of our suggestions come from Soviet Russia.
Well, it's interesting because you talked about the various American presidents who had terrible senses of humour. And I'd love to tell you that Brezhnev was a dab hand at the whoopee cushion. But I read an alcohol. Jesus Christ.
I read an
interview.
That's very telling. Week four of isolation. Ben is reading beer at this point.
Some fascinating articles on the side of Buckfast. I read an article with the Russian-American comedian Yakov Smirnov, who's a brilliant guy, but it was big in the 80s. He was talking about the clubs that he used to play, but before he went and played clubs, his routine had to go to the Ministry of Culture, and in the Ministry of Culture, there was a department of jokes that had to vet the jokes that people could say on stage, because obviously, if you say the wrong joke in Soviet Russia, you're in a lot of trouble. There's an old Soviet joke of a judge walks out of his chambers laughing his head off, and a colleague approaches him and says, "Why are you laughing?" And he says, "I just heard the funniest joke in the world." And his mate says, "Well, go ahead, tell me." And the first judge says, "Well, I can't. I just gave someone 10 years for it."
This is literally a committee designing jokes.
Yeah, it really is. There is apparently a running joke in Russian political discourse called the bald hairy joke, which refers to the succession of leaders who have led Russia since 1825, that they go bald hairy, bald hairy, bald hairy. It even goes through Medvedev and Putin batting the presidency back and forth because Putin hasn't got any hair and Medvedev, a famously hairy man. But Yakov Smirnov was asked to tell one of the jokes that went through the Department of Jokes committee, and this is what he came up with. An ant falls in love and marries an elephant. They have an amazing honeymoon, a night of wild passion that is so passionate, in fact, that the elephant collapses and dies in the middle. The ant, however, is even less lucky. He's forced to spend the rest of his life living days digging the elephant's enormous grave. That's the joke.
Oh, sorry, I thought that was the setup.
No. That joke was apparently anti-communist and needed to be banned.
You're kidding me.
Nope.
It's not a joke. You got sent to the wrong committee.
Yeah.
So that got banned by the committee. That wasn't even their edited version of what might have been a funny joke.
Oh no, I think that was the edited version. Maybe I don't know, maybe that was the edited version, and then the Department of Jokes writers' room went, "No, we can't release that." This week, our nominees for the world's worst joke are Barry's early Renaissance joke book, The Facetiae, which I originally took to be the name of the witches in Macbeth, who were just doing a spell to really wind him up in a smarmy way. Luke's suggestion of Obama's laser-guided roast put-downs of Donald Trump during the correspondence dinner, and mine of the Soviet Union's Department of Jokes generally, and specifically that one about an ant digging an elephant's grave. As ever, gents, well done. We've gone through a variety of different centuries. I think this is a pretty easy one this week, because Barry, me and Luke both laughed at a couple of yours.
True.
Mine is irritating, but doesn't really have a body count behind it, whereas Luke's, yours, we've all watched live, and we watched the effect that it had on the person it was about, and the fallout over the past 3.5 years, and who knows, maybe the next 4.5. So I find it difficult watching that footage now. I really do.
Yeah.
I can't watch Trump generally. It's really, I find it very hard to watch. It raises my blood pressure watching him do anything now. So I just read about it rather than.
Well, you don't have, so you don't have to listen to his annoying voice.
Oh, I just can't. It just, it's like, yeah.
I remember some reporter saying that half of the job now is to try and interpret the news that is being relayed by the president of the White House, and the other half is like translating his broken English into actual like bite-sized quotes to put into articles.
Well, and that's the thing, of course. That's one of his great skills, is because he's so good at not finishing sentences, and so he's kind of like a Rorschach test. You can hear him say what you want him to say because he can finish saying anything.
Oh my god, Alan Moore was more right than he knew when he wrote Watchmen. Before we go, it is time for the world's best news of the week, which we will continue doing throughout this coronavirus crisis until it's time to tell you a little bit more about how the current affairs are awful. And we go to Bedfordshire in England this week. You may have heard of various people have been doing wonderful charitable works. Some people have been running marathons in their back garden. I know one man who climbed the equivalent of Everest on his staircase, which, to be honest, I thought was extremely irresponsible because, you know, what if he got stranded and there'd have to be a Zoom call from some St. Bernards? Anyway, Captain Tom Moore is a gentleman who is 99 years old, and he is aiming to walk 100 laps around his back garden before he turns 100 on April the 30th. He says his motto is slow and steady, and he has so far completed 70 laps of his challenge. As of Tuesday morning, he had raised over £1.8 million on his Just Giving page.
He's up to 3 million now, apparently.
Oh, is he? Obviously, it's the sort of heartwarming story that our awful sociopathic government will use as a happy cat to throw on the table after all the dead cats to distract from the lack of investment in the NHS. But ignoring all that context, what a lovely story. What a lovely man.
I love the fact he set up a Just Giving, and the target was £1,000 for the challenge. And aww, then just like, because social media can do this, and eventually it reached like the BBC and the Guardian are all reporting it now. So now he's like 3 million people have donated to this man. He's walking around on his walking aid in his back garden.
We're an absolute sucker for a heartwarming World War II veteran.
Yeah.
Smashing stuff. Before we go, Luke, where can people find you and what can they find you doing when they get there?
Well, at the moment,
address and postcode, please.
I'm on Twitter at @jlukeroberts. That's where I stick most of my things. I'm currently trying to write 1,000 different dystopias on there, which is going surprisingly well, but really isn't the coping mechanism I thought it would be. and my website is johnlukeroberts.co.uk, and news of my live performances will one day hopefully be put straight back up on that website again.
Marvellous stuff. We're all off to find any errant time travellers and persuade them not to go back in time and kill Hitler, but instead to go back in time and give Barack Obama coronavirus in 2011. Until next time, goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.